Welcome to Life on the Illinois Prairie. Your host is Wendy Fleming Dexter, and after 30 years living in small town Illinois, she has stories to tell. Past cornfields and factories, into the heart of Amish country. There's more here than what meets the eye, far beyond what you think you know. So buckle up and stay tuned. This is Life on the Illinois Prairie.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Life on the Illinois Prairie. I'm your host, Wendy Fleming Dexter. Joining me today is a gentleman that we've really not met or even seen each other up until today, but I'd like to welcome a talented author and artist, Timmy Valentine. Timmy, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Wendy. Nice to meet you. Thanks for having me here today.
Well, it's a pleasure. It is a pleasure. I want to start off by saying, is tomorrow a special day besides being Friday the 13th? What day could that possibly be?
You've done your research. It's tomorrow is my birthday.
Ah.
Isn't that exciting? Yeah.
It is exciting.
I'm celebrating my 50th birthday. Yeah.
Ooh, on Friday the 13th. Years. What's going on that
right?
day? You must be having a party.
I know. I love it. That's my lucky day. Actually, no parties for me. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Well, we'll keep it nice and quiet, and I don't like any, maybe a cake. That's all I need.
That sounds good. What's your favorite flavor?
Whatever comes, that'll be my favorite, right?
That would be mine too. That's mine too. Cake is cake. Well,
right?
happy Friday the 13th birthday. Yeah, no kidding.
Thank you.
No kidding.
Thanks.
Well,
thank
that's
you.
Wonderful. I hope that it's a wonderful day for you. Now, we'll get on, if you would, to tell some background information about yourself, how you came to, what has been going on in your life since you came into the world 50 years ago yesterday, or tomorrow.
Well, let's see. I was born in Central Illinois. I was born in Monticello, Illinois.
I love it.
I'm told I'm one of the last babies born at Kirby Hospital, which is a tiny small town hospital in Monticello. I grew up there on a dairy farm called Country Charm Dairy. They provided milk and dairy products for the entire region. Their reach was far, I'm sure. When I was born, though, in 1975, they turned from dairy production to cattle production just for beef. I grew up on that farm. We had, you know, extensive apple orchards. I think there were like 5 lakes on the property. It was very rural. We were only about a mile out of town, but you could not be farther from town, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Work on the farm sort of keeps you isolated. So I grew up in that. I grew up in that environment. I'm the youngest of 9 children.
Oh wow! Big
family. So I'm from a giant family. Yeah, there was 4 boys, 4 girls, and me. But all of my siblings are they were all old enough basically to be my parents. I have a sister that's 11 years older, and then the rest of my family they all had children already, basically. So.
So you must have been a surprise.
I think I was an accident, you know, like, you saved the best for last, though, I'm going to say, like,
I'll just put that
out there for people who are the last born, like, of their family. So that's it. So I grew up on a dairy farm / cattle farm. We, you know, apple orchards, lots of woodland. The location, actually, while I don't describe it immediately, the feel of my childhood home plays a big part in a lot of my artwork. And then I also brought it into my books. Yeah.
I wondered about that. I wondered about that in some of your art, if that landscape around the area of Monticello, it's a beautiful, beautiful area, and Allerton Park and all around there. I wondered if any of those places played a part in your art.
Absolutely. I think that as a child, I was very observant of my surroundings. Like, I was hyper vigilant about processing that information, and my brain for some reason cataloged it and it comes out in my artwork. Like, I do reference my childhood a lot in my work.
Mm-hmm.
I do use a lot of, I think that there are more secret references in my work. It wouldn't be necessarily, you wouldn't walk up in front of one of my paintings and immediately know that I had referenced something that came from my childhood. But, you know, I think that we, as people, we walk around with all of this information, you know, about our experiences. And that's something that I draw on continuously, you know, in my work.
Do you think, as the youngest, that maybe since there weren't a lot of there were other siblings around as much that you, because I know I was the only girl and I was next to the youngest. And before my brother came along, I mean, I'd be out in the yard, you know, staring at anthills for an hour at a time, watching the ants move. I was, you know, I made my own entertainment because there wasn't much of anything else on the farm because I grew up on a farm too.
Yeah. Oh my God. So I would say with me and my particular experience is it was interchange, this contrast between vast, endless, lonely, you know, emptiness, where the farm was empty because no one was there. And then there would be occasions where there were, you know, we would have 80 people in our house trying to have Thanksgiving dinner, you know? So it's like the contrast for me was this extreme, which has fed me my whole life. I love extreme contrasts. I love that feeling between, you know, energies. And so that it was important to me, I think, growing up. Not that I would have chosen it, but looking back on it, it fed me creatively because I had to fill that space. I had to use my imagination. Like you were saying, you have to cultivate this inner world in order to, you know, survive, you know. So that was it was a big deal for me.
So you are involved with the Little Theater on the Square also, aren't you?
I am coming out of retirement this year. I think I don't quote me on this. And if anyone out there has done the math, please forgive me. I think I've done 34 shows there. I started out 20 years ago. John, who you've interviewed for one of your podcasts, he and I moved here. We bought a house here about 20 some years ago. He took over you know, running the Little Theater on the Square. And he called me in one day, knowing that I could paint. And he said, I need you to paint a show. And I just said yes. Which now I would have, if I had a time machine and I could go back, I would negotiate differently. You know, I would say, I would ask how much first, you know, but I didn't. And so I started painting for him. And then he asked me to design and a children's show. I think my first children's show was Willy Wonka. And so I helped design the set for that, paint the set. I also did all the costumes. I think there were, I'm going to say there were 70 kids in it or something. I mean, it was ridiculous. So I spent months sewing Oompa Loompa costumes and doing all of that. And then from there, it just sort of, anytime John needed someone, he would, you know, get me to come in and do it. I had some great experiences with, I met some insanely talented people, you know, through those experiences. I would say, if you're contemplating a life in the theater, you have to understand that it's not a job, it's a life. It takes up every ounce of your energy, and you can't walk away from it. It's, there have been shows that I've done. I did, I costume designed two productions of Chicago. And during those productions, I remember there were mornings where the people working with me, we would walk out into the street at 5 a.m, you know, and having worked all night long. And then you go home, you have something to eat, probably a cold slice of pizza. And then you lay down on your bed, pretending you're sleeping for like 2.5 hours. And then you go back to work, you know, so there's no... I believe when John was doing Mamma Mia, he costumed it. He and our partner Ty, they did 73 hours without sleeping to get that show going.
Wow.
And then
the
next day they were able to have a break, and then they went back in and did, I believe, about a 40-hour turn. So it's a love. You have to surrender to it. You know, if it's going to be good, you have to surrender to it. And I think a lot of people don't understand the pressure of that job, you know, working anywhere in theater?
It couldn't be just a little hobby for sure, because if you're going in and doing what you guys are doing, something that has a timeline and you have to be prepared for an opening night and then have to do that every time.
It is. I've told people that, like, when you go into tech, which is that last few days before the curtain goes up, it's like, you know, you're seeing people in costumes for the first time. You're seeing the lights for the first time. It's like you're on top of a speeding train. There's no seatbelt, and you're like hot gluing feathers to the top of it while it's rocketing like 100 miles an hour down the road. And you know that it's eventually going to drop off a cliff, and you're just on it, you know, and you just have to just keep dusting it with glitter, keep gluing feathers on it. And then hopefully eventually you get applause. And when you hear that the first time, when you hear the audience reaction to something that you've done, it's incredible. I mean, it's instantly rewarding. I mean, it doesn't make up for the long hours for sure, but it's really special.
Yeah, I never thought about, I mean, I realized that the people, you know, the people who do scenery and all the people that work behind the scenes do, you know, do an incredible amount of work. Without those people, the show would not go on. But I would think about it from the actor's standpoint of getting the applause, but I never really realized how rewarding it would be for those of you who are the unsung heroes behind the scenes, that all that, you know, that you'd, the how rewarding that would be to finally, it's like, wow, be validated for all that hard work and all that blood, sweat, and tears.
It's a beautiful thing to say. Like, I would say from a costumer's perspective, when an actor walks out on stage, you are half of that character, you know. What you've created for them helps them embody that, you know, character completely. Otherwise they'd be out there in jeans and a t-shirt, and who wants to see that, right? Like,
right. Yeah, just saying the script and doing the words and mouth and going through it is just going through the motions until you put the whole puzzle together, and that completes it, I'm sure.
Absolutely. I would say that one of a really great example of that is I've gotten the privilege to work with an actress. She's actually from this area. Her name is Therese Kincaid. She's one of the creative directors here. She and we've worked together on multiple shows. She's one of my favorite people to work with. So if you're hearing this, Therese, you're welcome. She's incredible. And one of the things that I really love about her is when she comes in for her costume fitting and she's putting on the outfit. And sometimes it's just the first few pieces of an outfit that you see her brain engages in this way. You see the wheels start turning, and how is she going to, and her body sort of changes. And we got to work on, and I'll say it was a privilege. We worked on Les Mis together, which is an incredible show. And she played Madame Thénardier, and she came in for her costume fitting. And I just remember she came in as my friend, and we were having a conversation, and she put the clothes on, and she became this character right in front of me. And it was one of the most magical things I've ever experienced, is that she, you know, each layer she put on, she was feeling it out. How do I do this? And how am I going to, you know, and it was magic. It was absolute magic. And I got to be a part of that. So I'm very thankful for that.
Well, I bet. And, you know, it's so different from, you know, other, you know, acting in a, something's going to be filmed or on TV that's not live. When something is live like that, and you have to inhabit that character and be that person for that time frame. And that's just got to be something incredible to see, to know that you're a big part of making that happen.
I am so lucky. It's tough. And again, I said I retired. I'm coming out this summer to do Hairspray. I'm going to do the costumes for Hairspray. John asked me if I would come and do that, and I'm really looking forward to it. There's a special crew in the costume shop this season, and so I'm taking advantage of that so I can work with them. And we'll check back in with you after I'm done with it, and you can determine whether or not I survived in one piece mentally, you know. I don't guarantee anything for sure.
Well, I bet not. But what have you met? You said a lot of people that you've met that have had impact. What have you met? Well-known people come in there? I know that John had told some stories when he was over the years, people that have in. And since it's such an amazing place, the Little Theater.
I'll tell a story on John about this really quick. You'll love it. Like, John has this, let me just tell you about him a little bit. Like, we'll make this interview about him because he deserves this moment. Like, he sort of, people don't understand what he does here, I think. And the Little Theater is a springboard for talent, right? So it used to showcase stars, but now stars, you know, they'll come here and get their equity card, their Actors Union card, and then they can go on and they'll work in other places. And when you, being in New York City with John, I've been lucky enough to travel there a couple times and with him, and how many millions of people live on Manhattan? And you'll walk down the street and literally every single time I've been in the city with him, if we're on the sidewalk, he will get stopped by somebody who says, John Stevens, because I mean, wild. He's touched so many lives, you know, wow. And he has zero ego, which is the most interesting thing about him is he has absolutely no ego when it comes to that kind of thing. And I see him every day help people, even when they don't realize that he's doing it, to get to that next level, you know, to express themselves in a way that puts them in front of other people, helps them make connections. And they may not even know he's backstage saying, you've got to hire this person or you've got to take a look at this person or whatever. But we have met some incredible people. I'm sure he mentioned Marisha Wallace. I was lucky enough to costume her in a couple of shows. She's gone on to sing for the Queen of England before she passed away. And then, you know, for her son, the King of England, she's, you know, famous on the West End in London. She's been on television there. She was one of the live singers for Dancing with the Stars UK. And she's done all of these things and she's an incredible person. I could list everybody. I should have brought a list. I think that, a part of me, it blacks out when I think of theater. I'll be really honest with you. I may have PTSD from it. So, but yeah, I've worked with a lot of people, a lot of really incredible people, both on the stage and behind the scenes, you know. I guess I should have just mentioned all the people that I didn't like working with. You know, that would be a more interesting interview, wouldn't it? Like, if you want that list, I'll give it to you privately.
Thinking that in this little area where we live in Central Illinois, to have a gift like something like Little Theater on the Square that is just so phenomenal and so rare. People just, the opening to this thing my podcast talks about passing cornfields and beanfields, and there's more to be told. There's stories, and these stories, Little Theater goes back for a long, long time, and hopefully will go on for a long, long time due to the work of a lot of hard work of a lot of people like you and John and all the other people that work there.
He does an incredible thing every season. And I think that, one of the things that really amazes me is there, you know, they have a huge drama program where kids can come and actually perform. And like, if you can get up and you can perform in front of like 450 people, you can go on to be anything you want in the whole world. That's no joke. Like, you can be a doctor, a lawyer. If you get past that fear, you know, of walking out on that stage, you literally can do anything that you want. And I think a lot of, you know, we should beg John to do a class for adults, because I think so many grown-ups could have that same experience and it be life-changing, right?
I understand that. He had talked to me when he was on about some kids that, you know, had been bullied in school or that were having issues, people being mean to them. And once they come and have that transformation of being in front of the live audience in the theater, how they builds their confidence, you know? And just gives them that, you know what, you can say what you want, but I know who I am. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I get that.
It's incredible. I'll sign up for that class any day. I've seen it happen firsthand, you know.
Why that? And to be able to go back to that phase of life, if I could go back to my junior high and have that kind of confidence instilled in me, I would have taken a whole different path in life. And instead, Stacy and I, my husband, we have an acoustic duo, and we sang on CI Living a few times when it was still a live show. And I've only been singing a couple of years. He's been singing for 60 years out in public. But for us to go on a thing like live TV and sing when, you know, I'm no Celine Dion, I'm nobody, you know. And so we get on there. That, to me, once I could do that, what the hell? I could do anything if I can go out and sing in live TV. I'd be the best in the world by any means, but I did it and we've done it several times. What the heck? So I see how that that can build your confidence, and you know, to be able to. So it happens so much later for some of us, even to be able to do this podcast. We started this when I'm 71 years old.
I love
it. Heck,
I love that.
The ageism thing, it just gets me more every day. It's like, you know, people say, "Well, boomer." It's like, yeah, boomer. Yes, I'm proud of my age, and I'm going to keep going as long as I can, and I'm going to try to step on little people like you call me boomer.
I get it. If I could go back, I don't think I would change anything though, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But if I could take some of this information and sort of send it in that direction, I think I would be a better person when I was in my 20s, you know.
Oh yeah. Well, I would definitely have gotten married a lot fewer times in my 20s and 30s.
I don't know though. I don't want to give up, you know, of all the things I've experienced that I thought were bad at the time, I wouldn't give those up now.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
like I wouldn't.
The bad things that I've done that I didn't end up in jail for, I'm really happy about. You know, made some really poor decisions, and I'm here to tell the story. I wouldn't give those things up for $1 million. My trip to Amsterdam,
it's flavor.
Uh-uh. I'm not giving that up. Getting stopped by the customs people coming back in, I ain't giving that up. You know, it does. It layers your life in a way that, you know, it's not. Not dull and boring. I mean, you live a slightly on the edge, but not so much that you're, you know, endangering yourself in a serious way. But yeah,
agreed.
I think all those experience, you know, take you to a place that add and make you, I think, make you a lot less judgmental, in my opinion.
100% agreed. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So now the reason John sent me the message and suggested about you being on here is how on earth I want you to tell about your book, The
Sure.
Agency of Dust and Power, Book One.
Correct.
Now.
You got it.
You, if I understand, you've been working on that since... Tell the story. You'll tell it much better than I could. I'm hearing it secondhand, so I want to hear it right out of your mouth.
Okay, so back in 2019, like early 2019, so pre-COVID, like I hadn't set up a art studio for myself, and I'm a painter, and I was holding off on setting up a permanent art studio space, and I decided I've always written as well. You know, when I was little, I painted and wrote poetry. You know, I did all of those things. And so in 2019, instead of setting up a art studio, I just started working on a few short stories. I started writing poetry again. I started working on some short stories. And one of them just really sang to me, one of the short stories. And so I just sort of set it aside and I just continued writing in this sort of a theme. And then the next thing I know, I have hundreds of pages of material. And so what happened is the book has a little bit of, and I don't want to give anything away to people other than the energy of it. There's a post-apocalyptic vibe to it where the world sort of stops and people have to figure out how to survive and how to keep moving forward. And when COVID hit, I decided that the material I had written probably needed to go on ice for a minute because it was the world was, you know, in chaos and people were trying to figure out, you know, what our place on the planet was and how we could interact with each other. And so I decided to put the material on hold. And then it's always just been burning around in my brain. And so off and on for the last however many years ago that was, 6 years or something, I would add to it and I would just, you know, I would use notes, the notes feature on my cell phone. And I would go in and I would sort of take up space and go, okay, this character does this. And so I started fleshing out this thing over the course of 6 years, just whenever I had an inspiration to do it. So there was no pressure. And I think when you're a creative person, if you can isolate yourself from any kind of pressure, when I was younger, I would create for other people. And now I can just specifically create for myself. And that's what I did. I just made it all for myself. I didn't think about who was going to read it. I thought about the characters and how, and I fell in love with the characters. They're very important and special to me. And so when I was faced with turning 50 about, I don't know, a few months ago, I decided I was going to publish the first volume. There's so much material that I was able to divide it into three separate books. And so with turning 50 just around the corner, I decided I'm going to publish this first book for myself. And so I didn't want any pressure, outside influence in it. Mm-hmm. I think that's so important. And so I recruited a friend of mine who's sitting in here with me today. Lori, I asked her if she would help me with the manuscript, help edit it and get it ready for publishing. And she jumped on it. She's one of John's best friends. And so she also had to keep this secret from my family. And for the next 2 months, after I decided to green light this thing, I went through the editing process with her help. And, the day that it was published, when I received a copy of it for the first time, I took it and I presented it to my partners, John Stevens, Tyler Mosher. They were blown out of the water because... And it, in the back of the book, if you ever get a chance to look it over, there's actually a little author's note that explains to them all of the times when I was with them, you know, if we were at the gym or we were out shopping or having dinner at a restaurant, and I just turned to my cell phone, like I wasn't on Instagram. You know what I mean? I wasn't on Instagram. I wasn't checking Facebook. I was writing my book. And so now when I handed them this book, they went back through for the last 6 years, like all the times that I had just gotten distant in the car, you know, and they started calculating like all the times were like, oh my God, you know.
So it all made sense all of a sudden.
So I surprised everyone in my family. I surprised John and Ty with this book. I wrapped it up. I had a box all ready for it and everything. And I put the first copy came in the mail like 3 days earlier than it was supposed to. And I throw it in this box and I, you know, told John, Ty was actually working on Mary Poppins, the show that's happening right now at the theater. And so we drove over to the costume shop with the book, and John didn't know what was happening. And I had them both open the box and they were like, oh, it's a book, you know? And then they looked at it carefully and they were like, oh my God, you know, my name is on it, you know? And so they were just, they had 1,000 questions. John literally, he was speechless for 3 days, I think. I mean, John and Ty are my best friends. So like we talk about everything, and I had, you know, and they know that I'm very protective when it comes to my creativity. I don't like any outside influence. And so they were just flabbergasted. Like I think if you were to ask them today, they still haven't processed it, you know?
Yeah.
And so it felt so good to make it a surprise for them. But in truth, in all honesty, it was for me for my 50th birthday. You know, I wanted to get the first book out there, and there's nothing like a birthday as a deadline, you know, to say, I gotta do this. Because, I mean, we spend our whole lives sort of putting things off, you know?
Yeah, right.
Like, oh, I'll do that tomorrow, or especially something for yourself, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. If it's for you, it's harder to commit to it. So I think I'm trying to change that. And so, like, if it's, you know, when I paint a painting, it's for me. And if somebody else loves it, great, you know? Right. But I certainly don't work for others. And that was a huge change for me to do it that way. Anyway, so the book was born to great fanfare.
Well, I saw the picture on Facebook when John posted it, and you guys and everybody was so elated. It was just a wonderful, joyful moment to see.
I think I should have taken a picture of John's face. I should have taken a picture of his face. He had to sit down in a chair. I'm not going to lie to you. You know, and yeah. I think in the picture, Ty is actually sitting in a chair because they were both like, they both were like looking around the room for something to sit down on, you know, because they were like, they were trying to process this huge thing. But I think they're both incredibly proud, and I'm so happy that it's out in the world and people are enjoying it. I'm getting really great feedback from it. So I'm in the editing process of book two is happening right now. So
wow.
That's a good thing. It's it's been something really important and special to me, I think.
Well, I would say so. And the fact that you could do it, you know, basically right under their noses, and that they, that you've been doing it off and on all those years. And I love the fact that, you know, you're turning away to write a note on your phone. That sounds so familiar, because, you know, I know we always try to keep our phones quiet when we're, you know, when we're out to lunch or something, so that we don't, you know, have to do, if it's something important, we will. But, you know, it's funny, after all that time, they're probably thinking, oh, that all makes sense. Everything makes sense in hindsight now, looking back at that.
100%. I know that there's one chapter in the book that it's one of my favorite things. And Ty and I were working out. We work out together every morning, unless there's a theater emergency or something. We're always at the gym. And he and I were working out, and I had this incredible, this force was moving through me to finish this chapter, to add to it in a way. And I just was over in the corner, and I was typing on my phone, and I was laughing because it's a little funny, it's a little hysterical. And I was cracking myself up, and he just kept going, "What are you doing? Like, you know, what are you doing?" And I was like, "None of your business, you know, like, don't look at me, stay away from me." Like, so now he has all the answers, though. Like,
that's funny. Oh my gosh.
And I'll say they are sharing, and I'm happy to share with them the process on book two. Like, I'm in the midst of, you know, putting all the pieces together, and they're able to, I'm coming home and saying, I finished chapter 18 edits today. You know, so they're expecting regular updates, I'm sure.
Isn't that a riot? I just love that. I think it's such a cool thing. So it's so often, you know, when people are doing something like that, they are pressured because they've told people what they're going to do. And there's that outside influence of, are you done yet? Or where's, you know, especially if you're working, you know, with a publishing company or something, and you have to answer to them, which Lord knows I would never have had to do.
I wrote
a book
yeah,
too, but it wasn't quite the same as yours. Mine was
keep the next
different.
One secret. It adds to the flavor of it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty poor at keeping secrets.
Well, this will be your chance. Like, this will be your your one big secret. I think that I as a creative person, I understand, and I'm learning this from listening to other artists as I grow as an artist myself. And the one thing that, you know, people continuously say is, do not involve anyone in your process. Like, and I think in the age of Facebook and Instagram, they put themselves out there so often. And there's a difference between being vulnerable and, you know, and being, you know, and engaging with the planet. You know, it's vulnerability is it's important, right? But it's also not, it's a gift. It shouldn't be something the world expects from you, right? I think we overshare is what I'm saying. I think that we got into a habit of, like, you know, you go out to dinner and you're photographing it. It's like, well, I just want to go out to dinner, you know? I think we should be more selective about it.
How about being present in the moment? We go to concerts, and you go to a concert, and you got almost, you know, real close seats to the front, but everybody in front of you has got their camera taking a video of the concert instead of enjoying the concert. That is so frustrating.
Agreed. I feel like, you know, we should do a whole entire conversation just on that. It's so important to me, and I've learned a lot about myself and about being in the moment. And if you ever get a chance, there's a book by Eckhart Tolle. It's called The Power of Now. And it's one of the books that Oprah Winfrey says she always has on her bedside table. He's a brilliant author. You can find him on YouTube. He gives little speeches. And his whole life he dedicates to bringing us into the present moment. And, you know, pain and suffering and sorrow, those things don't exist in this moment. You know, it's... and it changed my life, that book, really. It's one of my my go-tos. He taught me how to meditate properly just by being so kind and gentle. And I think that we're learning about ourselves through the lens of social media. And I would say, you know, can I predict the future a little bit? I think within the next few years, we'll see a younger generation just completely remove themselves entirely from social media. I don't think that it can perpetuate. I don't think it's something that can continue without without a younger generation saying, that's not for me, you know? Let me just say, I think a younger generation, we're building it for them, right? Like, I feel like they're going to rebel against it and say, I don't have a social media, you know? And I'm looking forward to that moment.
It is a double-edged sword in many ways. I mean, you know, all the there was so many positive things that you can see on there, things that can be joyful and enlightening. You know, when here's the birth of my new child, here's a grandbaby, here's somebody going off to school, graduating eighth grade, high school, college. But then you've got all the negativity, the hate, the viciousness that's just sometimes not ending. And it's just not, it's not good for anybody's spirit in any way, shape, or form.
Exactly. I agree 100%. I think that one of the most dangerous things about social media, that it's so sneaky and so is to it's comparative culture. It's like, you know, we're constantly looking out into the world and seeing other people who may be better at something that we are, or better looking, or, you know, their career is advanced in a certain way. And, you know, we're sort of expected to follow and to like, and to all that this person's experience. And in our head, in our own subconscious, that starts building this, you know, energy that's, that keeps us from being our best selves, you know, our own selves, because the self, the person who we are, the here to be, that comes from a little bit of isolation, right? It comes from going out and taking your place in the world, but it comes from being introspective and sitting alone and understanding who you are as a person. That's not something that you can do by posting something on Facebook. It's something that you do alone at home in the dark, right? Like you're truly by yourself.
That self-examination that can say, okay, what can I, what is the universe trying to tell me, and what am I putting out into the universe? Because they're generally two different things.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. I think that as a creative person, I'm learning. And David Lynch, who just passed away, he was a filmmaker. He discovered Kundalini meditation, and he would teach classes. He would go out into the world, and he would be brought into universities and things to speak to students who were going into the creative fields. And the one thing that he would start and end the whole, you know, his whole lecture would be about meditation, be empty, you know, for as long as you can, because that's where creativity comes from. Otherwise, we're just responding to the world, right? Like I find myself as a painter, like if somebody likes a painting, then there's this little part of me that says, well, you should make 6 more of those, you know, you should paint that 6 more times, you know? And it's something that I fight against, you know, and try to find myself in. And I did the same thing with the book. I isolated myself so that the characters were my characters and not something that I was, you know, not a result of my, you know, trying to be popular or try to be understood or try to be, you know, mainstream. It was important to me to be true to myself in my work.
Doing it for you and not for the number of likes it would get if you were posting it on social media, right?
Absolutely. If you look at my social media, I have like 200 people. And I've been to dinner with probably half of them. So I do not have a following of people out in the world for sure.
So what, your art, where is your art to be found? I know that I looked on the different Saatchi? You said Saatchi?
Absolutely.
How did you pronounce that name of the
Saatchi,
the art gallery? Saatchi.
Yeah, I'm probably also not pronouncing it correctly, but yeah.
But you have some beautiful things on there. I mean, I know nothing. I'm not a person to be an art connoisseur, as you can tell by the way I'm dressed. I'm not a fashion maven either. So, but I do think that they're beautiful. What you said, not my shirt, but your artwork. So where can people view that if they'd like to look at that?
You can get on my website. It's timmyvalentine.com. That's where I have, of course, I don't have all of my work on there. I just have like a curated selection of it. And from there, You can learn about me. My bio is on there. You can also then click from there to go and see the work that's available on sachiart.com. But check out my website. It has my latest work on it. The stuff on Sachi is from earlier in this year and from the last part of 2024. So my latest work is there. And from there, you can also find me on Instagram and things like that. I try to keep my website fresh every couple of months. When I remember to do it, I will post pictures from my studio. I'm working on several series right now that I'm really proud of. So I'll get those on there. Now that I have the pressure that people are going to listen to your podcast and go to my website, I'll have to go actually post some stuff on there. So thanks for that.
There'll be more pressure if you share this with some of your friends so that they'll listen to it.
Absolutely. You got it. You got it. I'm looking forward to doing that.
Yeah. You scratch my back and I'll have somebody scratch yours.
Absolutely.
Not the way the saying goes, but
that's exactly how it goes.
Well, this has been just a lot of fun. Is there anything else you'd like for people to know or you'd like to talk about the book, your art, or the little theater,
anything else?
I know you can come back and talk again with some other things, but we've only touched the surface about some things.
I would love that. Yeah. I would love that. I think check out my artwork. I'm happy where I am as an artist today. You know, I think I've really come into my own as far as my paintings and things like that. I'm really proud of the direction I'm headed. Definitely check out the book. I think if you give it a chance, this is just the warm up for book two. So definitely dive into it. I feel like my book hopefully is a little bit challenging, so that people have to really set themselves aside a little bit when they're mm-hmm. going to read it. I think from the very first character you're introduced to, it changes your mind a little bit about what a book is about, you know.
Mm-hmm. And where do they get the book? Is that on Amazon?
Yeah. So The Agency of Dust and Power, it's my debut novel. It's book one. If you get onto my website, timmyvalentine.com, I do have a page that will take you directly to Amazon. It's available worldwide on amazon.com. Also, the Kindle version is available. So if you have a Kindle, I will tell you, if you're reading it on Kindle, there is a bonus chapter from the second book that's hidden on the end of the Kindle, the Kindle version, the Kindle manuscript. So you get a sneak peek of book two. And I specifically, when I added that to the Kindle version, we have a dear friend, her name is Pippin. And I imagine her flipping through and finding that chapter and absolutely squealing when she reads it.
What?
So it's a... It's a little sneak peek. So also, I'm in the process of the book is being recorded for Audible. So within the month, it will be available worldwide on Audible. So if you have an Audible subscription, my book will be available. It's being read by a really talented artist, actor, and I'm excited to see to hear the finished product. So within a month, that'll be out there in the world as well.
Well, that's so cool. Then when people get done with your book, they can listen to my podcast, which is also on Audible. Isn't that exciting?
Absolutely. I love that. Actually, I will, if you remind me, I will make sure that gets onto my website. I love that we can link to that.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
That's it. You're welcome. This has been an exciting thing.
It's exciting to me to have you here. I told you when we got started, it's like I couldn't find a lot about you. I mean, I knew what we've talked about. You're an artist and you're an author. And I teased you about, you know, what I didn't find. I didn't find any you know, pending trials or anything. So I knew that was probably pretty good.
That's great. That's good news. It was so good to talk to you. If we have four more minutes, I will share with you, I have my top five books of all time. Oh, how about that?
Please do. That's fine.
I'll share that with your listeners. Yeah. So I prepared my top five books. The Girl Who Owned a City from 1975 by O.T. Nelson. It's 50 years old this year. This book changed my life. It was written for young adults, but it's absolutely a book everyone should pick up and read. Absolutely life-changing. My second on the list is Our Lady of the Forest. It was written in 2003 by an writer named David Gutterson. He actually, it's a life-changing book. The way that he writes, it's rich. It feels human. It's absolutely indescribable, but it's unlike any other novel I've ever read in my life. And then 1997, an author named Arthur Golden wrote Memoirs of a Geisha. You've probably seen the movie. If you haven't, you should. But this book was also life-changing. It's absorbing and it's engaging, and it changed the way that I look at reading. It changed the way that I, when it was adapted into a film, it changed the way that I saw movies because of his writing. Another book that I love and you should put on your list, you'll absolutely adore it. It's a quick read, I promise. And don't let the author scare you off. It's The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. It was written, it was published in 1999 by an author you've probably never heard of him. His name is Stephen King.
It sounds unlike familiar.
Doesn't it, right? You should Google it. I think he'll come up if you Google it. Anyway, yeah, he's going to be famous one day. I hope that I help that happen. It's one of his best books, and I think it's one of his most overlooked works. And I'm going to not lie to you. If you get a chance and you can find the pop-up book on eBay for under like $1,000 or something, it's both a novel and then it was adapted into a pop-up book. You can laugh all you want. It's a life-changing book. It is unlike anything he's ever written. It was meant to be just a simple short story. And it's a book and an experience of reading it that comes back to me every time I visit the woods. I'm going to tell you that. I look around and I assess danger. Anyway, it's a sweet and it's a kind and it's unlike anything he's written. I'll just say that. And then the last, like the number one book of all time that changed my life, it's 49 years old this year, Interview with the Vampire, Anne Rice. When she wrote this book in 1976, she knew it was going to be something special. And when interviewed later, she would go and she would say she knew it was important and that if she had to type out every copy herself and put them into a little red wagon and go door to door to sell this thing, she was going to do it. And it turned into be this massive, it's a cultural phenomenon. It started with this book, Interview with the Vampire. I remember getting a copy of it at a garage sale in Monticello, Illinois, when I was a kid, for probably a quarter or 10 cents. And I stayed up all night long to read it. And I just remember being like, oh my gosh, the world that she created within this book, it was so transportive. I needed it at the moment I read it. And so I wanted to share that with everybody that's listening today, for sure.
Well, thank you. I will, when I do the promo for this, I'll write in there to make sure I have a piece of pen and paper handy toward the end so you can make notes of not just your contact information, but your top five list. That's great.
Absolutely.
Speaking of Monticello, have any of your friends or neighbors had any encounters with the movie this with John Goodman or any of the people that are doing the movie up in Monticello?
I don't think so. I keep hearing about it. I'm not really in touch with a lot of people from Monticello. So, I don't get there often. I think it's been 10 years maybe since I've really been there. I have an aunt that lives there that I visit like every couple of years, but, I haven't. The Monticello actually plays really heavily in the book. There's some scenes in the book that are, you know, Allerton Park and places that I went and visited as I grew up. So my first book has a lot of references to local, locations. I'm excited that Monticello is it's on the movie map.
We were just up there. We were just up there a few weeks ago for the peonies in the garden, and because peonies are my favorite flower in the peony garden. And we got Stacy and I get to sing. We have an acoustic duo. We get to sing in the Allerton Museum or Allerton Mansion this year. We've never gotten to sing up there, let alone be in the mansion. So we're kind of excited about that.
I love that.
I don't know
that.
If we're going to be in the basement or what.
Oh my gosh. they'll put you in a closet somewhere.
Yeah, I wouldn't be. You know, there's worse places to be. But
I know. You're going to have so much fun. So the book, in my book, Allerton House, it actually plays sort of, you would think of it as a character for a couple of chapters.
Really?
You know, I took liberties, of course, with the location, but I grew up going there. I spent some time in the house when I was in my early 20s working on projects. So it plays a huge part. I think it's a magical place. It's actually a magical place in the book. So you should be sitting there reading it between sets when you guys go and do your performance there.
We're going to be getting that book. I promise you, I will be getting that book. I can't wait.
You'll love it. And I can't wait to, give me a report after your acoustic set there. I want to hear about that.
We'll do. Well, Timmy, it has been so much fun. I appreciate you taking your time to come here today, and let's do it again.
It was a blast. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank John for making the connection.
Absolutely.
Oh, I appreciate it very much, Timmy Valentine, being here today. And that will bring this episode to the close on Life on the Illinois Prairie. And everyone, please be kind. Thanks for listening to Life on the Illinois Prairie, the undercurrents of our American life. If you haven't yet, go ahead and subscribe to Life on the Illinois Prairie wherever you get your podcast. Stay tuned for more stories, interviews, and updates. I'm your host, Wendy Fleming Dexter. Until next time.
Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.